Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello there. Welcome along to the Huddle Breakdown. This is the podcast that looks at the stats, the performance and the XG of Celtic Football Club. We're streaming live across YouTube and Twitch. So if you're watching, do leave a comment below, get involved in the conversation tonight. There's lots to get involved with, or there's lots to talk about rather, over the course of this podcast. We're looking back at the defeat to Rangers in the first game, the first derby game of the season. And we're going to be looking at a little bit about the squad and how it's looking now that we have a fully fledged squad. We know what transfers have come in. We know what players have left. So we're going to be looking at that, but we're going to be focusing mainly on the game from the weekend. Alan Morrison, Celtic by Numbers, is with me as always. Alan, how are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Enda.
And Jico James as well. How are you?
Good. As I mentioned to you guys, broadcasting in the midst of a hurricane. So if you hear any loud noises or the power goes off and I disappear, then you'll know what happened.
Cool. We had a couple of storms in Ireland last year that were vaguely similar to what the States get. And they were fun because we just went to the pub and everyone got the days off work. But that was, that was different times when nobody was working from home. Anyway, Rangers 1, Celtic 0. That's what we're talking about. I was so positive going into the game and then a 1-0 defeat and a dreary enough game. Can I start with a bit of a debate here before we get into the nitty gritty of the game? The Hollander goal. Hollander got the one goal of the game, comes from a corner, free header at the back post, essentially. And there was a bit of an online debate between Boys Analytics, between GigPod, between a couple of people online. Should Hollander have been marked at the back post? Or should Hart have come and punched that ball? So that's where I want to kick this podcast off tonight. I think that Hollander should not have been free at the back post, personally. I don't think Hart is getting to the ball. I think it's too high up in the air. But I'm curious to get your thoughts. So, Alan, do you want to kick us off here?
Yeah, I mean, on that point, I would agree with you. Hart's not going through all that traffic to such a high ball. That's massive risk. You know, something's gone awry in terms of marking. And Hollander's got a relatively free run. And actually, that was the only effort they had on goal from a set play throughout the whole game. So, you know, all this, you know, the predictable gnashing, wailing of teeth, and, oh, Celtic have conceded another goal from a set piece. Yes, they did. You know, I will do something during the break, actually, around difference in set piece performance, defensive-wise and attacking-wise, because I think there's a lot of interest. I'm sorry, I'm broadening the point out here. in both of those, compared to where we were last season, both in terms of how we set up defensively and how we set up in an attacking sense, is quite different, actually. And I believe we'll see an improvement in performance, but I haven't studied the numbers yet, but it's something I will do over the break. But long story short, answer to that question, yeah, I think there's been a mix-up somewhere, but I think between Rolston and Welsh, and Hollander's not been picked up.
James, do you want to jump in on that?
100% agreement. The only thing I can add is I did rewatch the game last night for the first time, and it appeared to me that on the preceding corners, Welsh was marking Hollander.
Okay.
So they did something to shake that loose, and you know, again, mistakes happen. So it was a mistake and happened to be a good delivery from a guy who's pretty good at delivering those balls. And Hollander's a decent guy in the air, big guy. And, you know, he didn't head it right at Hart. So, Yeah, I mean, the funny thing, tongue in cheek, I say, you know, not ha ha funny, but more tongue in cheek, is in my mind, it wasn't terribly dissimilar to the goal that we conceded in the 2-0 to Goldson last year in the COVID game. And, you know, Barkas got absolutely hammered by a lot of people in that, which I think Alan and I discussed subsequent to that, once we started the show, that we didn't think that that was, you know, people were calling jelly wrists and all these other things. I don't think that was Barkas's fault. And this wasn't Hart's, even though he didn't come for the ball. I agree with Alan's assessment. That probably would have been a bad decision. And, you know, it was a good header. Hart got a hand on it, but, you know, I don't think he should have saved it. Would have been a miraculous save had he made it. So, you know, I think it probably was a mistake in not marking him and in marking Hellander. And to their credit, I mean, they ran interference for him. You know what I mean? I mean, that looked like it was a play of sorts to create that cluster of crowd in front of him. So
yeah, it's a very basic corner, really, when you look at it from a cold perspective. That's what a lot of teams do. They bunch their guys in and into the middle, and then they create diversions. One forward gets in between two defenders, blocks off the man that's supposed to be marking the guy who the corner is going to, and it's a goal. So it was a fairly basic set piece. It was nothing fancy, but it was effective.
We'll probably revisit this as we talk about the squad then, but you know, when you don't have a lot of size in your team, that does impact your strategy as far as whether you're going man, zonal, or some combination. So, you know, that's something that we're going to have to probably just live with as we go forward relative to, particularly domestically. I mean, we're going to be undersized probably a good bit against a lot of teams. Not necessarily lower athleticism overall. You know, a guy like Kyogo's not tall, but he can jump. But, you know, we talked about this before. That's when you get into the difference between a running jump like Hellander had and a guy who's got a fistful of shirt and jumping off of 2 feet like Starfelt tried to do to cover up for an unmarked guy. You know, he's just not going to, and he's a couple inches shorter. So, you know, all of these little fine margins add up at times. So, yeah, we might be better coached and better strategically on these, but we're not going to grow. I don't think any of our, maybe about a couple of guys are young enough that they could, you know, grow a couple inches still, but for the most part, our guys are probably done growing. So
take them up to Highlands, feed them a wreck of spuds over the next couple of months. Maybe a couple of them will take a little bit of a sprouting, but yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I think the only benefit for Hart coming for that ball, and I said this loosely on the Monday agenda, is that it might cause just enough chaos to put Hellander off. But the cost of that, if he doesn't do that, is a goal anyway. So the cost risk benefit of doing that, I just don't think it added up. So I it was a goal. I think it was a disappointing goal to concede, but the game itself, we want to get into that. This was just a carbon copy of the last four Derby games, wasn't it? A little bit, probably a better performance that Celtic have put in over the course of those four games. But ultimately, it was a situation where Celtic matched Rangers. They were as good as them throughout the game. They didn't take a couple of key chances, and then they concede.
I think you have to exclude the 4-1 where they spanked us.
That's fair enough.
Other than that, yeah. I go ahead, Alan. I mean, I think generally that's.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Celtic, given the context of where the team is and its development, you know, can't be devastated by that. I think we're all frustrated because, I mean, watch the game, and it was just a really, really tight game. You know, to actually lose it didn't feel quite right. I know, you know, Celtic obviously dominated possession for what that's worth. The XG, I had it at 1.04 to 0.99. There was really nothing in it. You know, the Rangers had significantly more shots, 14, but 9 of them were outside the box. And actually, Hart only made 3 saves, balls that he could just literally have flopped on. They created zero chances, where Celtic had three big chances. There was Edouard's chance, Furuhashi's chance in the second half. McCrory makes a great save. He's out really quickly to close him down. It's a tremendous save.
He had an excellent game.
Yeah, and then the one after that where Furuhashi squared the ball that's not reflected in the XG, but that was a great moment for Celtic. So the three great moments, you're really looking for them to take one of those. If they do get a lead in the game, it's a very different game. So I think, you know, a draw really would have been a fair result. It was interesting how both teams played. In some respects, you know, what I said before, I really didn't know what was going to happen. I thought it was going to be a little bit chaotic. I thought Celtic would introduce variance into the game, which they would not be used to. But actually, I would say Rangers would be pleased that they were able to play the game on their own terms a lot of the time. You know, and actually, they looked like a team, as they often do, who are playing away in Europe in the 1970s, are quite happy to walk away with a 0-0. It's a very solid, compact, low-risk football. There was a tremendous amount of packing going on in the game. I mean, huge amount. But generally, it wasn't the defenders that were being packed. Celtic's defenders did push on quite a bit. Balogun and Barisic, not so much. They were very conservative, mainly held their shape. Because they had three guys up front who were narrow. And I think the ploy was to let them rotate, let them play, whilst keeping a very, very tight shape in between and not get caught in transition. And that worked out really well for them because Celtic didn't really create anything on transition. So I think, you know, again, they were able to play a lot on their terms. Celtic had more possessions in the box, 15 to 11. They outdid the sort of packing side of it. Each keeper made three saves. It probably should have been a draw. It would have been a fair result, I would say.
James, your general thoughts on the game itself?
I actually think Alan's point there on Rangers controlling the game to a degree, meaning that is my main takeaway, meaning that, that was not an Ange ball game, so to speak. Right. I mean, we basically ran into a strategy and a tactic that we ended up playing the vast majority of that game on their terms. And I shared some heat maps and stuff in my post game thread on that. I mean, we've had very little central possession. One of the main times it happened led to the big chance when Abada played through to Kyogo and then he put that great crossover. So that's been, dating back to the first two derbies under Rodgers prior to him leaving when Gerard first took over. The first one, we pretty much spanked them. That was the 1-0, I think, and Cham scored. And we could dominate, even though it was only a 1-0, we pretty much dominated that. But that was before they had the reinforcements. That's before they got Davis. So that was early Gerard tenure. And the second one around the holidays, I think they ended up beating us. And ever since that game, with a couple of exceptions, they won a man down one game, that kind of thing. We have not, with a single striker system, whether it was in 4-2-3-1, which is what we've played mostly against them, or kind of the hybrid with the 4-3-3, depending on, we just have not been able to get the ball centrally. And whether it's like I joked, rinse and repeat, whether it's been Edouard and Forrest at striker and to the right, this week it was Edouard and Abada. They've just done a really good job of that narrow system and isolating those two players. And we end up going way left, heavy left. Juranovic had by far the most passes and touches in this game as our debutant and right back playing at left back, which probably isn't ideal in the grand scheme of things that you want him in his debut game being the one on the ball the most. So, when I kind of bundle that all together, I would say they got more out of the game as far as game flow and how it unfolded. They played conservative, they played defensive, and they nicked a set piece, which is exactly, look at the formula, how they've done well in Europe against teams like Porto and Benfica. I mean, that's one of the things I've talked about in the past is that their strategy and style of play isn't really optimized for domestic competition. It's more optimized against better opposition in Europe, and they kind of try to get by domestically breaking down, and they've had mixed success at that at times, breaking down kind of low block teams. And that's my continued concern is, you know, quote unquote, Ange ball, we're going to destroy a lot of domestic competition. But how's that going to scale relative to better European competition? They're going to come at us, and not sit in a low block, that kind of thing. We'll find that out in a couple of weeks here with Betis and Leverkusen.
It's an interesting one, that the European comparison, because last night Real Betis announced the signing of Hector Bellerin from Arsenal, and it just goes to show you the step up in levels, where we sold Arsenal our best fullback and they have just bought Arsenal's fullback. So that's a stage where, I know Bellerin wasn't starting for Arsenal for a while, but that was largely down to his injuries. That shows you the levels of competition we're going to be coming up against. I just thought that was an interesting point, a little bit of a sidetrack, but I guess I actually watched this game cold, like some of you guys do. I had my own game. I couldn't watch it live. And it is interesting what you pick up when you're not caught up in the emotion of it. And Ange Post pointed this out after the game, and it's one thing that was blindly obvious, is that the forward line setup didn't work. He got it wrong. He admitted that. What impact, Alan, did this have on the game? What impact did putting Edouard out on the left and Kyogo have?
Yeah, so I think Edouard started through the center.
I got that mixed up.
So listen, you know, and again, I'm not going to get into this kind of characterization of Edouard that is the lazy characterization of Edouard, which is a lazy characterization. But this is a guy who clearly knows he's playing his last game, right? And although, you know, he was constrained, I mean, if you look at his numbers, I mean, 7 challenges lost, none won. You're talking about someone who's completed 7 passes in the whole game. He didn't create a single chance in the whole game. He didn't make a single meaningful forward progressive pass in the whole game. He didn't take anyone on, beat a man in the whole game. He had one big chance that came off his heel, which is really a concentration thing. His packing receiving stats were very low, only 3 passes received. Compare and contrast that with Furuhashi's 24 and even Abada's 12. he was virtually, I hate to say it, but virtually invisible in the game. So there was nothing that was being offered on that side. Furuhashi, I thought, had an extraordinary game when you added it all up. You know, he had by far the highest overall packing score, nearly 200. He had the highest expected scoring contribution at nearly 1. He had the my cat score, which is overall attacking threat. He had a score of 12. The next highest was 4. He found space. He got on the ball. And it was what was really strange was that simultaneously, Juranovic and Furuhashi on the Celtic left had tremendous games and were progressing the ball really effectively. And Balogun at right back had a great game as well. So they all had really good games all at the same time. But the net result was, we did, you know, Furuhashi either created or got on the end of the best chances that Celtic created. And again, they take one of those. It's a very different game. So Edouard, you know, was unfortunately almost completely marginalized to the point of you know, you barely knew he was on the field. Furuhashi was exceptional and found a way to influence the game, both from an attacking left perspective and from, when he moved to centre forward, then suddenly, you know, he was able to get between the centre backs quite easily, actually, and was outpacing, you know, Helander and Goldson with ease.
I actually speculated before the game that Rangers may have lucked into McCrory starting over McGregor. And it actually turned out that way, I think, because I don't think Alan McGregor gets to a couple of those balls the way McCrory did on those through balls to, and there was one earlier in the game that Edouard was close to getting onto that McCrory, that's an example of kind of traditional keeper stats aren't going to gauge that.
Yeah.
But those, you know, him coming out to, and he forced that, the second Kyogo decision, you know, he created that pressure. Now, it may have ended up being the wrong decision or not. I don't know. I mean, it's pretty angled. Both of those chances were fairly angled for Kyogo. I mean, he was not dead center. He was kind of off to the 6 yard box.
Sorry, James. He had for the second chance. He had more time. If he'd actually taken the shot decision, the likelihood was that he would have been able to, you know. Whereas with the first one, McCrory was so quick and so on top of him. But that second one was actually a better chance because of the time. Yeah, that's like fraction of a second more.
Yeah, but my point was more so the second one was he had the time, but I think in the multiple XG models I looked at, I think it was like a sub 0.1 pre-shot XG just because of the angle. So you know it's hard to beat a keeper from that severe of an angle. So yeah, I actually think I think we might have scored a couple of goals there if McGregor's playing. As we've seen, you know, he had more of the Gordonitis at times in his career where he comes out and kung fu's people like Craig Gordon has in the past, you know, where you get a red card or, you know, penalty or something like that.
Or you don't.
Right. Fair enough. but yeah, so I think that was an interesting aspect of the game that, you know, the other part I wrote about this was, because of the issues that we've had with Ed Ward as a sole striker, and Alan and I have talked about this. I mean, I think it was the first piece I wrote for Alan's site back in early 19? I don't even know what year it is anymore. Was about whether or not Ed Ward was better suited as a second striker, you know, and there was all this talk, you know, Gordon Strachan at one point saying he's not a nine, he's a 10. And you know, when you look at his performance levels at Celtic, when he's had a strike partner that's actually a striker, that was always been my criticism. They kept putting Elyounoussi with him in a two-striker system, which made no sense. But when he's been paired with a guy who stays around the box, which is, I think, what the recruitment of Adjedi was supposed to be to replace Griffiths, is he's been exceptional. And I think to go into this game with the game plan as – regardless of whether he was leaving or not. I mean, I think there was just a structural question as to why that was the plan above and beyond, you know, the clear issues that we saw as far as potential effort issues or maybe his mind being drifting a little bit for obvious reasons. But I don't think we'll see that mistake again. The only thing I'll, as far as Kyogo not playing through the middle, the other thing that I found interesting was, his Kyogo's dribbling stats in Japan was kind of high volume, but not great efficiency, meaning that he's not giving an example. James Forrest has won like 2/3 of his dribbles pretty consistently through his last 5-6 seasons in Scotland. And I think Kyogo was more of like a 50-50. In Japan. And I think we saw some of that. I mean, it's obviously just the game, but you know, Balogun's not the niftiest guy. I mean, he had a great game, but you know, he's a center back playing at right back. He handled Kyogo pretty reasonably well there. And I think that's another thing. I mean, I don't think Kyogo is a guy who we might be getting now with Jota. That's Jota's reputation. You know, we've seen that with Abada. Abada's got the athleticism, but maybe not the ball control on the ball. He had kind of the same issue in Israel, which is high volume, but maybe a 50-50 as far as winning those kind of things. And I think we saw some of that from Kyogo on Sunday. I'd be shocked if we don't see him, even with the new striker coming in. I think we'll see Kyogo through the middle.
What's considered a successful dribble? Is that like you get past them and play a pass?
Yeah, you beat the man and keep possession. Okay. I mean, that's thing.
There's two different, slightly different flavors that I capture, Ender. So the packing aspect is if you dribble past somebody. So you take the ball, you run past somebody, they're now behind you. Mm-hmm. Okay, and if you keep control of the ball and then can perform your next action, then I say you've completed that pack dribble. The second aspect is what's called a progressive run, which is essentially about gaining yardage. So you've run with the ball, and I think it's the common definition for this is really kind of 10 meters or 10 yards. If you can in the opposition half, anyone can take the ball from the edge of their own box up to halfway. But yeah, you know, against opposition. So if you can, against opposition in the opposition half, move the ball forward at least 10 yards on a run, that's a progressive run. So add the progressive runs and the pack dribbles you get together, you get your ball running ball progressions. Okay. One of them takes players out of the game, the other one only gains yardage.
Okay. Yeah, I guess the reason I ask is that Kyogo is quite small, not the strongest. So if you get tied to him, you'll probably win the ball, or you're probably preventing him
he had five progressive runs, meaning he ran with the ball into space. I don't know if he had even attempted to take a player on. What I notice a lot with him is if he receives the ball and someone's, you know, fronting him up and he doesn't think he's going to beat this person for pace, he's quite happy to actually stop dead.
Yep.
And just play a very deliberate but very firm pass. And he's very economical, I would say. If you compare Kyogo's technique for receiving the ball and giving the ball to Starfelt in terms of motor skills, it's quite the contrast. One is just an economy of effort and minimal body movement. The other one is like a piece of theater of drama to be able to move the ball forward. So
I think it was Starfelt at the start of the season that I said it just looks like he's processing every bit of movement that he's trying to do before he does it. It surely must be down to rustiness, or either that he's just not very good on the ball, and in which case it's going to cause him issues.
It's a new system too. I mean, he may not be used to having fullbacks inverted, and the idea of him learning a new system in a new role and having to scale up from maybe doing 30 passes a game to 95 passes a game. You know, since I always talk about this concept of scaling, you know what I mean? It's like, if you're good at something 30 times, that doesn't mean you're going to be good at it if your volume picks up a ton. And the complexity of your actions go up. So,
I'm going to do a piece on him, and I'll just do a little bit of a spoiler, because I watched him very closely, and everyone after the game, the general consensus was that Starfelt had a good game and get off his back, which I like, because I'd said exactly that after three games. And he actually won 12 duels, and which is second only to Ralston, who Ralston's defensive performance was excellent. But he lost seven. And his problem broadly is it's Duffy-itis. Two things. He gets too close to his man, and he tries too hard to win balls he can't win. And it happened, it didn't just happen a couple of times. And actually the goal came from a free kick that he conceded in a central position, which was then played into the box, Hart knocked out for a corner, and he scored from it.
I think he tackled Roof, right? That was the one he tackled.
Yeah. And I'm going to do a piece on this, because this is a coaching thing. This is a technique thing. It's a technical thing that I think he's got real issues with. And now it might be driven by confidence. It might be driven by the Duffy factor of, oh my God, you know, I feel under pressure. I'm going to try too hard to make up for any perceived errors. It might be that. And therefore, it may be salvageable. But I'm concerned he's fundamentally got some really bad technique.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. Before we move on to the squad, then, anything else from this game that you guys want to point out or find interesting?
I think a couple of things I'd like to point out. Maybe three things. So Juranovic, let's mention him, right? The guy's chucked on the pitch to play left back. Never played for Celtic before. I mean,
Welcome to Celtic.
Yeah. Real quick, Adam, I'll just throw it in this context because I shared this, and it's just, you know, it's crazy. People say, well, he's played there before. I actually looked it up. So he's 25 or 26. I forget. I have it written down here somewhere, 26, yeah. So he just turned 26. That's actually what it is. His birthday was in August. So going back six seasons, pretty much his senior career. So I have most of his data from his senior career. So it's like 17,500 minutes. He's played like before yesterday, Sunday, which was, I think, 97 minutes or 94. He had played like 508 on the left side. So he's played there, sure. But to be thrown into those circumstances like that was pretty remarkable.
It's like when a job is advertised and it says high-paced work environment, and you just know that means you're doing way too much fucking work for the job that's involved or the pay. That's what Juranovic got into.
But listen, I don't generally make snap judgments on players. I usually give it the old 900 rule, but I was kind of quietly impressed with this guy. He looks like a footballer. Things I look for immediately on any player that I see are first touch and balance and basic athleticism. And he had all three of those. So I'm really encouraged by just the fact that he's got the what I call the basics and the fundamentals and what to me are predictors of who's going to be a good player or not. Those are the basic foundation levels for me.
Say calm on the ball too.
Oh, his temperament in the game. Considering the environment, you know, getting, you know, paper balls thrown at him, poor dear. He actually ended up with the highest defensive action success rate, 77%. That was the best in the whole team, which for a fullback is unusual. 77% is high for a fullback. It's usually around just over 50. He had 15 recoveries, which was only bettered by the two centre backs. He completed more passes than anyone else, 92. He won possession back 6 times. He actually was the most involved player in the team in terms of overall touches. He had the highest packing stats of anyone in the team. 18 pack passes was less than Starfelt, but Starfelt's were all really just breaking that initial press such as it was. Juranovic packing score was the higher. Obviously not a huge amount in the final third, but he also had after Kyogo, he had the second highest pack receiving stats. That's in being on the end of forward passes, which again for a fullback is quite something. So you add all that together, it was a tremendously tremendous performance, really, if you think about it. And if you actually get, and also the other thing was, unlike Ralston, who's clearly not happy inverting, again, he doesn't do it very often. Taylor, bless him, I don't think he's got the tools necessarily for it, but my goodness, he tries to do it. Juranovic, he was straight in there on quite a few occasions. Because of his red boots, a number of times he got the ball. Like, oh, Christie's got the ball. No, it's not Christie. Oh, it's Abada. No, it's not Abada. Oh, it's Juranovic again. He's on the ball again. He just kind of kept popping up and getting on the ball. So I think that was really hugely encouraging, and he looks like a proper footballer. Another thing to say is midfield, whereas McGregor really did very little in an attacking sense. He actually had he won 8 challenges, lost 3. His defensive action success rate 73%. Brown very rarely hit 73%. So for him to do that in a derby, McGregor in that 6th position was quite something. But again, very little going forward. And then the other two, you know, Christie, you know, I watched the game throwing pelters at Starfelt and Christie. I'll be honest with you, because Christie gave the ball away in the final third for nothing on about 6 occasions. More than any other player, he had the ball in good positions and then he just lost it with carelessness. But at least he made up for it. He had one of his Leipzig-type games off the ball, which maybe I didn't notice at the time. Maybe not many people did. He was involved in 16 challenges. Only Starfelt was involved in more. So at least, although he created very little, Christie, and he did have one key pass at least, one secondary assist and one shot off target, he did at least do the dirty stuff. Whereas with Turnbull, you were like 1-7 in challenges, 1 and lost. He only had 30 passes compared to 35 for Christie. He didn't create a single chance. He didn't provide a single secondary assist. He only provided 8 pack passes, and he had a one shot on target, which was his ludicrous decision to shoot from that free kick, which went to McCrory. They went up the pitch, they won their free kick, and they scored their goal. So yeah. Turnbull was the one I should have been tearing the rest of my hair out of, not Christie, because at least Christie did the dirty stuff.
Yeah, and the only thing I'll add is, and this goes back to just matchup, and one of the reasons I think we've struggled so much in this game in midfield is Kamara and Aribo, their pressing-related stats that I have access to at StatsBomb are elite for the league. I mean, they're just really good playing the system, and they've got that athleticism and that physicality. And that's why I've been critical of us not being able to get the ball central is because I think the underbelly of that has a lot more risk, meaning that we saw that with Christie blowing past Davis a couple of times. You know, Davis is an older midfielder now. He's 36. He's not as quick. I've documented that on Twitter, where his rate of decline in Europe in particular has accelerated. And we just don't get to that underbelly between him and the two center backs who, you know, they're good players, but they're not fast. So that little triangle of, you know, in this game, Helander, Goldson, and Davis, we just didn't put it under pressure until Kyogo went in there. And then there was a little bit of pressure and we saw the chances that were created. And, you know, so that we've got to figure that puzzle out, whether it's Kyogo and us stretching them and him doing those off the shoulder runs, which I think will probably be part of the game next time. But there again, I suspect what they're going to do is get even more extreme and compressing because they're going to know that. So they're not going to want to come out of that shape. Mm-hmm. And you know, this was relatively extreme, leaving their three up front to just kind of do their own thing. I mean, when they got out on the front foot and attacking, it was basically three guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, Kamara and Aribo were coming forward a little bit, but Aribo's usually really aggressive and getting forward. And he was noticeably more reserved, I thought.
James, I want you to build on that. Those two, Kamara and Aribo, must do a ton of work because if you look at that,
it's amazing.
If you look at the front three, Morelos can barely run. I mean, I'm sure I would beat him in a sprint, right? Roof works hard, but he's not quick. And yeah. Kent switches off and goes to sleep. People run off him quite easily. And they didn't do, they didn't do a lot of pressing. Celtic's packing score in this game was insane, but it was mainly playing out through that front three and wide. So Aribo and Kamara must do a ton of work.
They do.
And
they're really good at it. The other part of that is, you know, so this would kind of be my other takeaway. So they basically dictated the type of game that was played, which again, it was at Ibrox. That's not the end of the world. None of this is the end of the world.
No.
Both teams are going to be completely different as we go into the next game in, I don't even remember if it's early January or right at the end of December. I forget. But around in the holiday game, it's going to be at Celtic Park. So I don't think there's a whole lot we can take away from this other than my one slight negative was that Ange did make some mistakes here, I think. Mm. And he, you know, I don't think that's controversial to say because he admitted one of them. when you get kind of pressured to make decisions, I mean, he had choices to make because of limitations on squad, because of Forrest being out in particular. And I get why he did what he did. I probably would have made the same decision as far as preferring Christie. Because if Rogic is in that midfield, I think that even if Kyogo was through the middle, if the decision was Christie left, Kyogo in the middle, and Rogic in with Turnbull, I mean, that could have been a train wreck. We might have lost 4-2, let's say.
Yeah.
It could have been a totally different kind of game that would have been more on our terms, back and forth maybe. Maybe we suck them out, but our midfield probably would have been a train wreck in transition then. It was kind of pick your battle here. And that's why I was curious to see if he came out of his comfort zone a little bit. Like I talked about, would he go with maybe four-man midfield with Rogic at the 10 and drop Abada? Go with two strikers, have, you know, Edouard play off of Kyogo, that kind of thing, which would have been, you know, that would have been a departure from what he's done so far. No question. So I didn't think he was going to do that, but you know, he kind of picked the worst option, I think in when he was limited. And so hopefully he learns from it. This is his first time encountering this specific system with these specific players. It might be, like I said, it might be different though, because they're probably not going to play Balogun again at right back.
I think the AZ game in midweek probably would have played into his thinking as well, with how much they tore us to shreds down the middle with Rogic playing there. So I think that would have played into it, especially the impact that Edouard had on the game when he came on as well. So, I mean, look, we said going into the game, it was almost like a free hit because it was a special occasion. It wasn't going to impact the season overall. So it's disappointing to lose it, but we will move on from it.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
You're listening to the Huddle Breakdown here in Breakdown Inc. If you're watching on YouTube, leave a comment below, or you can subscribe to the channel, get notified every time a podcast goes live, or you can find us on iTunes and on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts as well. I do want to touch on, finally, before we finish up, the squad and the final squad that we have now that the transfer window has closed. So overall, 12 transfers in total coming into the squad. Ozad Urakide coming in, Liam Shaw, Lil Abada, Kyogo, Carr Starfelt, Joe Hart, James McCarthy, Josip Juranovic, Liam Scales, Georges Giakoumakis, Jota coming in from Benfica, and Cameron Carter-Vickers, surprise signing in the final few hours of the transfer window last night, leaving the club, leaving out some of the players that, you know, Okoflex, that, you know, the players that aren't really impacting on the squad. The players that have left the club that will impact the squad is Odson Edouard, who's going to Crystal Palace, Christopher Ayer, who has left to Brentford already, Ryan Christie, who goes to Bournemouth. Interesting move for Ryan Christie. Scott Brown has moved to Aberdeen already. Lee Griffiths has gone to Dundee on loan. And Olivier Cham has left the club. I don't know if his club has actually been confirmed yet. I know he's linked to Swansea. It is Swansea, yeah. He was linked with Swansea. I wasn't sure if it actually gone through. So overall, it's a massive overhaul of the squad. And it leaves us quite thin in several positions. Look, I said it already in a video on this channel, 12 signings is a massive amount of people to come into the team. And I don't know how many more you're going to get in one transfer window. Like, you can make the debate around some of them should have been in, being in before the Champions League game. But 12 transfers in is a lot of people, a lot of bodies coming into the squad. I do want to focus on one position in particular, and that's midfield, because now that Christie's gone, the impact that makes, as well as Olivier and Cham, on the overall midfield is actually quite stark, because you're left with a midfield of James McCarthy, Callum McGregor, Ismail Assaro, potentially near Beaton, potentially, but in the past he hasn't played there in a couple of years, so probably not, David Turnbull and Tom Rogic. Your starting midfield is Cal McGregor, Tom Rogic, and David Turnbull. What happens if one of those get injured? And mainly I want to focus on Cal McGregor. Let's say Cal McGregor is not injured. Let's say David Turnbull is fit. What do we do with Calmac?
Before I answer that specifically, I want to step back and provide kind of a 30,000 foot context here. So we went into this with this huge overhaul in squad, with no technical director, no director of football, no head scout, no head of recruitment, and a manager who I'm a huge fan of and was an early fan of, but who does not have a track record of building teams, right? So he's you know, not at this level in particular and not in this market. So, you know, he's clearly a smart guy. He's clearly a really good football man, so to speak. But that's not a mix for, as I've called it, an architecture project. So, you know, the resources available here and, you know, I think we kind of got what you can expect given that context. And it's a lot of, you know, I go back to my Jenga tower. You're going to hear that every episode now. We don't have an optimized team relative to the way he plays. And I don't want to get into red herrings about who's an Ange signing or who's not. All of that to me is irrelevant. It's a red herring. I think everyone probably did their best. You know, they did their best to give the best options to Ange, and Ange did his best at helping to pick which ones would be the best options in his mind. All I can do is analyze what we have and the result. And I don't think it's anywhere near optimized. To your point, Enda, the midfield is very thin. We have over coverage in the defensive midfielder role. And we basically have three guys there that can play that position. And I would argue we don't have an eight.
Agreed.
We do not have one.
and yet we have two positions to fill in this system.
Exactly. So I don't know if this is going to push Ange to go to a 4-2-3-1, which I don't like, because that means, you know, McGregor's back to being where we don't like it, McGregor being, which is, you know, if you're going to play McGregor in that holding role, just make him the holding midfielder. and surround him with an athletic couple of eights that can defend and basically allow him to orchestrate like he's clearly shown that he's capable of doing. So I don't like the mix in the midfield. I think it's not coherent relative to Ange Ball. And the depth part is a huge risk, meaning that that's the one thing when you talk about, you know, Rangers Jenga tower, is I don't see a single midfielder that they would lose where their tower is going to fall down. Hmm. And if we lose Callum McGregor for any length of time, I think we're in big trouble.
Well, you see, that's where I find this an incredibly interesting discussion point, is that I would argue that an injury to Turnbull or Rogic is far more destructive to the midfield that Celtic are trying to put together than Cal McGregor getting injured. Because at least if Cal McGregor gets injured, you're putting in a Sorrow or McCarthy, or the replacements are there for the number six role. But if you take Turnbull or Rogic out of that side, then who comes in? Do you push Calmack into the number eight position, or do you push him further forward? Who comes in then?
What
are you missing then? If we're going to be dominating the games, the two players that we're going to rely on are the two attacking midfielders.
I think it's conditional, meaning that against, you know, St. Mirren at home, I think losing McGregor in that sixth role is the bigger loss. Because we've seen what that does already. I mean, it's we've documented the track record of that even preceding this season, how destructive that is to the opposition and has been. You know, against Rangers, if we played McCarthy in that role, is that ideal? In my opinion, probably not. But I actually think McCarthy slowing down buildup at home versus St. Mirren on the margin might cause a bigger problem than him playing against Rangers at Ibrox, for example, in that role. So I think the other part of that is that because McGregor is flexible, and this is a concept in other sports. I know Alan loves my other sport analogy, so I won't get into it too much, but somebody like Beaton, who can be functional across positions, or somebody like McGregor, who can be functional across positions, or Christie, who's functional across positions. There's an inherent value to that that is probably underappreciated by a lot of people. And I think McGregor's ability to function as an eight or a six, or even theoretically as a 10, there's a lot of value to that. So I think generally he would be the one that would be an absolute disaster to lose. I take your point, Enda. I mean, we're so thin. If any of them go down,
yeah, it's
you know, the idea that we're going to end up with Liam Shaw is a guy who's going to have to pick up a lot of minutes, which again, he's a young guy, but you know, he just doesn't seem to be quite ready yet. And he's only 21. So hopefully he comes on and it turns out to be a good signing. But, you know, again, this go back to depth. Rangers have basically two guys, and this is beyond any of their, you know, they have a couple really young guys that I'm not even accounting for, but they basically have six midfielders if Jack comes back.
Yeah.
Where if any of them goes down, not only do they have coverage, they have like another two or three guys that can plug in, or they could move Haji back, or you know what I mean? So they just don't have the risk factor that we do with even Kyogo going down. I mean, we basically now have a two-headed monster, so to speak, where if either of those two guys go down for any length of time, I mean, it's really, really going to be dicey.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. I will use your Jenga analysis or analogy rather and say we're only at the building stage. We haven't started actually playing the game with the squad yet, so we're currently building our tower. Alan, your general thoughts on the midfield, on the Cal McGregor conversation?
Yeah, it's absolutely terrifying when I actually sat down and thought about it, because we literally don't have a true number eight at all, and yet we're going to play two number eights in the current system. So that the absolute best I think we're going to be able to do against tougher opposition is have a McCarthy, McGregor, Turnbull. That is probably the best we can do. For games against bottom six SPFL teams, McGregor, Rogic, Turnbull, I'm sure will be absolutely fine. After that, who are you actually going to play? I think there are at least four players at who, if you looked at Celtic's squad, are first team wages that, to my mind, will not play. Right? So Barkas, Bolingoli, Bitton, Ayeti, I think, have been looked at. Postecoglou doesn't trust them. He won't play them. They didn't play when we were 1-0 down on Sunday. They didn't play when we were 2-1 down in Altmar. He would rather have brought on Montgomery. Okay? They forget them, right? They're not going to play. So what you're left with is Soro, who I don't know that he's convinced about, but he trusts him enough to put him on the pitch. And actually, I think Soro could do a number eight job reasonably effectively. And then you're into probably three players that we've got left that haven't been loaned out, which is Liam Henderson, who doesn't seem to... I've never seen him play central midfield for Celtic. He's always played an attacking wide position. I think they're concerned about his physicality. Luke O'Connell, who has never played a minute under Postecoglou, and Kerr McEnroy, who, bless him, I'm not sure is ever going to make it at Celtic. And literally, that is it, okay?
Can I add one, Alan?
Problem. Yeah.
I'll add one, because I had the exact same thought, and the only wild card that I can think of, and I had to write it down, is the Lawwell guy that we got from Watford. He's playing, you know, in the lowland leagues at 18. He just turned 18 in May. I only mentioned him because theoretically he could be somebody in the mix.
So again,
yeah, it would be desperate.
If I go back to who realistically have we got available, if you accept that the four players I mentioned, although they're first team players and although they're on big wages, they're just not going to be trusted to play.
Yep.
I've deliberately excluded the two Sheffield Wednesday boys, Shaw and Urugidi, because I believe, from what I've heard, that they're not considered ready for the first team. Okay. Right. And actually, the lad Lowell and even Dane Murray, who played in against Midtjylland, would be ahead. Which is why we had to sign Carter Vickers, because at the moment it's Starfelt and Welsh, and below that you're back to Dane Murray. He's 18. Okay, so that is another massive issue. So this is a real problem. Central midfield is an absolute, and it's not the only place we've got risks at the moment. On the left hand side, with Taylor and Johnston injured, your left hand side is Scales, who I've never even seen in my life, and you know, has the physique of a centre half, Jota and Montgomery. That is the left side. That is the complete left side of Celtic at this point in time. We've now potentially got two strikers. Because again, I don't believe Ayeti will play any meaningful minutes. And on the right, we've got Abada, Juranovic, and Ralston. And that's it. Because Dembele's injured and Forrest's injured. Well, I reckon at most we've got 19 seasoned professionals this time. And listen, this was an absolute triumph of asset management this window. I reckon, I know that transfer fees, in reality, they're paid in three tranches. I know they're amortized over the course of a contract. I know that there's agents' fees and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, all things being equal, looking at what's been brought in, what's come out, high-level numbers, we've spent around 20 million, we've brought in around 40. In this current situation, that's remarkable. And to get money for the likes of Bayo, Schwed, Hendry was quite an achievement. To get big money for Edouard and Ayer in this market was a massive achievement. So big tick on the asset management side. Hooray for the balance sheet, right? But in terms of, and I don't know if we could realistically have done more business given the huge turnover that there has been, but there is enormous risk as we go through the next 3 months.
Yeah.
And I wrote a piece on this for Celtic Way last week on risk, because, if there's probably one differentiator that I have relative to analyzing things is how much I've done on risk in my career. And so not only are we talking about this risk, which is thinness on the squad, lack of depth and quality depth, but you've got a style of play of the manager who's going to add a layer of risk on top of that. So you not only have a thin squad in some areas, you've got a style of play that's going to already stress a deep squad. And now we're going to compound that by having a thin squad. And then not only is the style of play aggressive, the volatility of his style of play is going to be pretty significant, right? So there's going to be some risk that just comes inherent with that. And that's statistical. I'm not going to get into that. Then you layer on top of that, the architecture risks that we've talked about, which is some of these puzzle pieces don't stick together. And I wrote a piece about this week is, you know, teams are going to bombard us aerially now. I mean, you'd have to be a blind man not to see the vulnerabilities that we have in the aerial game and the spacing that's going on with Hart and playing a high defensive line. So we already started to see that with Alkmaar. Rangers did it a ton. And, you know, you're going to run into teams that aren't well run like Dundee. They're going to try and play through us instead of just going long. But for the most part, there's some reasonably well run clubs in Scotland that are going to probably just bombard us. And they have bigger people and they're going to try and win second balls. And, you know, and because of the variance and the volatility of how we play that kind of thing, there's going to be some games where we just get bad luck. And there's a cluster of a couple of those shots that Kent took from outside the 18, one hit the post. Well, maybe that one goes in against Dundee United on the road, you know, those kind of things. And so when you layer all these different risks on top of each other, you know, injury risk, style of play risk, now we have a very definitive way to attack Ange Ball that may not win, you know, they may not prevent a team from getting crushed 6-0 one game, but the next game they might nick a draw just because they get lucky in the game. So, you know, you pile all those up and I'm very nervous in that regard. I think there's a lot of latent risk that's probably underappreciated.
Yeah. Well, we were told by the guys who knew Ange Ball that it was going to be a fun season either way. It was either going to be a disaster or it was going to be a really good season. So I think it will be a very interesting one, to say the least.
I did this work. I'm sorry, Enda. I did this work, Chris. I have to share it. right? So, you know, I've been highly critical of the senior management of the team, of the club. So in this is what, three summers ago. So this is not that long ago. I put up a, you know, because again, we have to benchmark our team now and think about, you know, how is it? We had this really tough window, right? This was, to Alan's point, I mean, this was a very difficult window to try and get all these players in and out in one of, if not the most illiquid transfer markets in history. So, I mean, you saw what St. Johnstone got for Kerr and McCann. Mm-hmm. You know, there, a lot of their supporters are understandably quite upset about it because it was a lot lower than they thought. Prices really came down. And so just three seasons ago, we could have had a starting 11 if we would have been managed a little better, of Edouard and Dembele up top, Tierney on the left. This is the 3-5-2 system that we actually went into that summer starting with before the disaster hit with China and Rodgers. Castagna on the right wing back, a midfield of McGregor, McGinn, and Ncham, and a back three of Iyer, Boyata, and Benkovic with Gordon and goal. Right. So think about the level of those players, their relative age profile, what a lot of those guys ended up going for, where they're playing now, a lot of them in top five leagues. And then compare that to where our team is right now. And it's miles apart. I mean, it just is. And that was done through decisions that we've made, overall asset management, the various transfer windows and the managerial hires, the lack of any real football structure, modern football structure in place. And you know, it's only taken 3 years to have that happen. Mm-hmm. So that to me is a legit Champions League level team that could qualify for Champions League routinely and compete in the group stages of the Champions League. Probably not get too far, but not be an embarrassment in the Champions League level. And now we're worried about playing Leverkusen and Real Betis next month, or, you know, this month, and hopefully we don't get absolutely annihilated.
Yeah, well, hopefully we don't get absolutely annihilated, and we will bring you the breakdowns of those games over the next couple of weeks. But to get them, you will have to subscribe to the channel below and subscribe to the Huddle Breakdown on Twitter as well, at the Huddle Breakdown. We don't have a game to analyze next week, so we might do readers or listeners questions. If you do have something that you want to put to us or want us to talk about, do send them in and leave a comment below, and send us to them on Twitter as well, at Huddle Breakdown. Alan, James, thanks very much.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Andrew.
All right, we'll chat to you next week. Good luck.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.